Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection. Today's day is Tuesday, the 20th day of November 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Another installment of the French Connection. It's great to have you here with me, as usual, for these most important of broadcasts. And I have to ask you all to really pay attention today to what we discuss, because the subject matter today is this financial implosion, which, if you've been listening to the French Connection as a regular listener, you know that I've always believed the events around anarchy and problems with losing our freedoms in the streets are going to be precipitated by financial events. And the financial events that I've worried and feared were on their way are actually happening around us. The results you can be seen across the world. France is actually experiencing terrible problems with their finances right now. The big reason why people are in the streets of France is because they have lost purchasing power from their currency. Many of the French workers are not able to make ends meet week to week, month to month. And we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, entire swaths of the French population becoming working poor as a result of inflation. And, of course, you know that the governments of the West have been lying about the true amount of inflation that has been leaking into the system for the last decade or more. They keep jumbling the number of things they put in the CPI, which is the Consumer Price Index, or they change the elements within the Producer Price Index, and they manipulate the numbers. They've been doing that for a long time. Here in France, they also manipulate unemployment figures, not counting people who have been on unemployment for more than a year. And there are tens of millions of extra people across Europe who are not even being counted as part of the unemployed. So basically, statistics are lying to the public, and things are actually quite a bit worse. But we all know how bad they are when we show up at the grocery store with a fixed amount of money and can't get enough food for our daily lives. So I'm going to bring up my guest today, someone I trust to give great information about finances. He's got a lot of experience in it, and you heard David Pidcock speak about this gentleman last night when I asked. His name is Mohammed Rafiq. He's been on the show many times, a good friend of mine, and we want to go right into this, Mohammed. You know, this debacle, this slide that we all see has some similarities to the 29 crash in that there has been a serious contraction of available capital to individuals. Not so much to the banks. The banks are getting money left, right, and center. But is it not true that the banks are tightening up their lending practices to the population in general?
Well, good evening, Daryl.
Yeah, good evening.
The reality of the banking situation at the moment is very, very serious, and it's completely hidden from view. Very little truth is actually being reported about how serious the situation is in the banks. The banking situation has arisen out of its new regulatory environment known as the New Capital Accord. We had the original Basel Accord, the original Capital Accord, and that was basically overtaken by these brilliant computer systems able to calculate incredible mathematics, and we now have the New Capital Accord, which on the box, according to the Bank for International Settlements and the banks in the G10 countries that enforced it on the world, it's supposed to be safer, better regulated, tighter, all these kinds of words. So against that background, we've got the claims of the new regulatory environment, and then we've got what we can actually see going on, Daryl.
That's right.
And this brings us back to the famous saying of Groucho Marx, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?
Well, your own lying eyes.
Yeah.
He actually said your own lying eyes. I understand that. Now, we're going to get into the technical side of it and the banking problems in general. But on the ground, for people listening to this who have relatives that have gone back to the bank to try to get extensions on their loans or even renegotiate, I just read a huge article here about how the banks are actually tightening up their available credit to the public. In other words, they're not making new loans. So what we've got here is a world awash in dollars, but to the rank-and-file plebiscite like you and I, the banks are shutting that cash window down for loans for homes or to extend their payment periods. So basically what we have is kind of a weird situation. We have a world repatriating huge sums of dollars into the United States economy, and none of those dollars actually trickling down to the people who need them the most, and then bailouts going to the biggest banks through the open cash window to keep these people afloat temporarily, which is only going to be a temporary fix, is it not?
Well, the thing is that the dollars themselves have become worth a lot less for foreign investors.
Yep.
The reason that a lot of them are finding their way back to the States, shall we say, is because people don't want to hold them.
That's right.
Especially the central banks. The whole situation at the moment is that the banks themselves can't lend money out because they're unable to do so, Darryl. It's not because they've got loads of dollars and they're tightening the window to the public. Actually, they haven't got the dollars. And the reason for that is because of the new capital accord. This used to be known, for some people who may have studied some of this subject on the websites or maybe in books, there used to be a system known as fractional reserve banking.
Mm-hmm.
And fractional reserve banking was this idea that if a bank had $100, it could maybe lend or give credit of $1,000 as long as it had $100 to cover it. In its capital, and it wasn't allowed to invest or lend that $100 out, but under the fractional reserve system, it could make loans of up to 10 times the value of its capital. And that system obviously started several hundred years ago and slowly got more and more abused, but now the whole thing's been put into the bin, and what we have in place now is the new capital accord. And the new capital accord has gone into a new paradigm, a new world, known as risk-based capital. So rather than coming up with arbitrary numbers, we have capital that the bank has to hold back equal to the level of risks involved, the monetarized risks. So we go through various mathematical formulae to calculate, for instance, in its simplest form, the VAR, the value at risk, say on a bond. We then apply some formulas which come out of the new capital accord as set by the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. And then we come up with an amount of capital that the bank is allowed to hold, or must hold rather, to cover that capital. And capital now is in three tiers, Darryl. We've got Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. Tier 1 is primarily AAA-rated sovereign debt. It's theoretically, as the saying would be, good as gold. It would be U.S. treasuries. It would be U.K. gilts. It would be a European Central Bank-denominated issue. So very, very strong. And for that, the banks don't need to keep much capital at all. They could keep literally pennies to $100, that kind of level. I mean, literally a lot less than a dollar to 100. They've got an enormous amount of that they can hold versus their capital.
Mm-hmm.
Coming down, we get Tier 2, which is high-quality corporates and high-quality banks, investment grade. And then below that, Tier 3, sub-investment grade. And obviously, we've got derivatives and all sorts of other stuff, futures and options and things and forwards, all finding their way into, some of it into Tier 2, very little, and the majority of it into Tier 3. And that brings us now to these CDOs, these collateralized debt obligations, or also known as mortgage-backed securities, which
right.
are blowing up all over the world at the moment. What's happened is that as these things have downgraded, especially from Tier 2 capital into Tier 3, with Tier 2 capital, we might need $5 on the 100.
Right.
Tier 3 grades all the way from maybe $15 to $100. Sometimes an asset can be so risky that the domestic regulator, say in the UK, the FSA, or the Fed in the States, will demand that $100 of capital are held back to cover this particular asset. Now, what's happened is that we've had AAA-rated housing bonds from some of the biggest U.S. corporations, which might have only needed $2 or $3 per $100 of capital, now downgraded to $25 to $50. So the banks have had a massive margin call on the amount of capital that they have to hold against these asset positions.
Now, these downgrades end up finding their way into somebody having to get paid for that downgrade. In other words, somebody bought the opposite side of the investment, and this is looking positive for them, if you will. In other words, every side of these investments have somebody picking up either side of it in most cases. So what you've got here is, as it gets downgraded, someone has to be paid off here.
Well, the people who are making, there's always somebody who makes. In the case of the bonds, it's usually the issuer, isn't it? But it may also be somebody who sold them on to second and third party in the secondary market.
Well, that's right. When you get into the secondary market and you buy a bond basis and you have the basis points at a certain discount and then all of a sudden it gets changed and you're on the short side of that, that means that you picked up a huge jump in your value.
Exactly.
And that short purchase that person had on those particular bonds, that's a contract binding. Now, I'll give an example in my personal life. Years ago, I was involved in a short sale that I didn't have a proper stop on and got caught in a short squeeze. And I got hit hard on the short squeeze, and they told me in no uncertain terms it needed to be paid off with cash immediately. And I mean, they had the right to come and arrest me if I didn't pay it.
And of course, Darrell, they've got the ability to bring strong arm tactics in for collection on those kinds of things. But just coming back to the capital point that I was raising earlier, what we have is a scenario where all the central banks are opening these windows to lend to the banks so that they can change the balance of their capital accounts, because by law, these banks have to have a minimum amount of cash that covers this risk-adjusted capital calculated value. And because they haven't got it, these central banks have been doing these repurchase agreements, started by Bernanke, where he said, give me your poor quality debt that's just gone from $5 to $25, $50, even $100 worth of capital. Give me that overnight. I'll give you cash of the face value, let's say 8%. So on the scales in their calculation, these banks have got rid of, or appears to have got rid of for capital purposes, appear to have got rid of these evil instruments that have just become valueless to them, these assets that have become valueless and a massive liability, and they've got cash to put in the other pan from the central bank.
Now, isn't that why Bernanke opened up the cash window for $41 billion in one fell swoop? That's a huge infusion for the overnight.
Well, I'll explain to you exactly who's going to be benefiting from that. But, yes, it has been open to cover these kinds of positions, absolutely, and to take and to continue financing these repo positions and to give banks cash so that they can actually balance their books. Now, the interesting thing is that this is only a mirage. This approach of Bernanke means that he temporarily takes these bad assets while the banks get cash in so that they can all sort their problem out. But they're looking at the size of this problem, and it's just growing so vast. We saw today that Freddie Mac and the Fannie Mae's have just lost 29% one stock, 25% on the other, because they've just announced massive losses, $2.02 billion losses. And these, as you know, Darrell, are the people who are financing the mortgages in the United States. The last quarter has been massive damage for both of these institutions. And all the people who are holding their bonds, the bonds that they've issued, this window is there to help back them out. But there's also a couple of very serious casualties which have just come up. A couple of days ago, there was an announcement that said that for Citibank now, it's more expensive for them to borrow on the bond market than it is for a high-quality industrial, Darrell. The cost of borrowing over base for Citibank is now 1.49%, whereas quality U.S. industrials are only paying 1.34%. For the first time in over 10 years, The biggest bank in the United States by asset size is paying more for its borrowing than corporates.
Because that's because of the packaging of these assets, isn't it? Now, let's go into that for a second, because we'll help everybody understand how these deals were packaged. Because what we found was that the subprime was only an element often in their secondary market sale or their forward selling of these financial assets. And in other words, everybody's telling us right now that the entire debacle of this subprime is in the $50 to $100 billion range. So, but that's not the real cost. The real cost is the fact that the entire packaging deal, which amounts to tens of trillions, possibly. Are all interwoven with each other, and so now these whole packages have gone bad. It's kind of like if you had a piece of a rotten fish mixed in with fresh fruit, you'd have to throw the whole bag out.
Well, what you'd have to normally try and do is unwind them, but you can't because they're legal obligations.
That's right.
What you've opened the door on here, Darrell, is a very big subject and one that we have to discuss because this is the contagion element. We hear this phrase, contagion. How does this confidence, this falling confidence spread? This is crucial. There are a set of transactions in the OTC marketplace, the over-the-counter marketplace, which are financial derivatives known as swaps.
Yep.
Swaps come in very basic forms now. We have straightforward interest rate swaps, and we have FX swaps. Just coming back to a straightforward interest rate swap, what that is, say you and I would agree on LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate, we would make an agreement whereby I would pay you a fixed rate over the next 5 years, every 3 months, of, say, 5% on an agreed amount, a nominal value.
Mm-hmm. Almost like an annuity.
Like an annuity. That's one leg of an asset swap. And on the other leg, you would agree to pay me whatever LIBOR is on the same nominal. And depending on whether the interest rate goes up or down above that particular fixed rate, we would then have a situation where you may be paying me or I may be paying you the net difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's a plain vanilla interest rate swap.
And now that plain vanilla has a winner and a loser in every case.
Yep.
And now if somebody's lost, well, one of them's going to lose. So the losing party in this, if the basis was poorly calculated, the loser in this has got big losses.
Well, they can be immense, actually, if people who don't understand what they're doing get involved. Now, where we get into an FX swap, a foreign exchange swap, what we could be doing is, and this is where it gets really sophisticated, is that I could pay you LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate, and you could pay me Euribor, the European Central Bank Offer Rate, in euros, and we would also agree an FX element, so that you can see there the contract is getting more complicated. And this brings us now into why we're going to get why the contagion, the meltdown, is so big. There's two other classes of swap. One's known as an asset swap, and the other is a credit default swap. And in both of these types of swap transaction, we use a reference object to come up with the basis for payment. So in an asset swap, we might use some of these Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. And what we agree is that you pay me Freddie Mac, and I pay you Fannie Mae, and whatever the difference between those two is. So rather than actually now using a published interest rate as our basis, we're now using assets which are in the marketplace. Now, we don't have to buy any bonds here, Darrell. What our legal contract says is that I'll just pay you this particular tranche of bonds here, whatever their coupon rate is, whatever their issue parameters are. I'll select them as my reference asset. You select those as your reference asset, and we just pay the difference between those two assets.
And when they're being sold in the first instance, they're sold as a zero sum. They're sold as an equal sum, and whoever's buying one is thinking that they're probably going to benefit in the future by it being out of joint somehow, by one of them becoming less or more valuable?
Well, what actually happens with professional swaps traders is that they now say, well, okay, I've got this particular swap here that where I'm selling this leg going that way and another leg going the other way, which means that I can now plug another contract onto each of those two. So we may have euros on one side and dollar on the other. What I can then do is I can now make two more contracts. I can take the dollar leg and do another contract that goes out into yen, and I can take the euro leg and take that out into, say, sterling, and then I just need a sterling and yen contract with another third party somewhere, and I can actually have four contracts, which have, what in the business we say, they've netted themselves out in the portfolio, but actually I've got an interest rate coming in for free, having passed all this risk on. And these traders actually have thousands and thousands of these swaps. In a medium-sized institution that I work for, Darrell, we would have 14,000 open swaps. And in a big bulge bank that I once worked for, they had over 100,000 open foreign exchange swaps.
Now, what we also have mixed in with this, the differential in interest rates that were being carried, and I'm going to call it, it's called the carry trade, out of Tokyo, out of Japan Central Bank, where their interest rate was extraordinarily low, where international traders were able to get their hands on these cheap loans with almost, and we're going to talk about this element later, without any moral hazard, and then carrying that zero interest rate and then going out into the marketplace and buying assets that with no money down. And of course, a zero interest rate is an asset with no moral hazard.
There were times, actually, where people were taking Japan government bonds and or even the yen itself and saying that if you want to deposit yen with us, you have to pay us. Goldman Sachs and other banks at one stage a few years ago, Dale, actually charged you money because they couldn't make anything with the Japanese yen. They would actually charge you money just to hold a large amount of yen on your behalf. It was quite perverse from a banking perspective.
So basically what we've got here is a house of cards, if you want to bring this down to from the boil. And it's a house of cards built on a very shaky foundation here, because all of these risk formulas that have been decided in this capital accord and then passed on to a bank interbanked business deals without any oversight, because of any type of OTC is happening between two companies or two banks. Or so what we've got here is the basis they used for this, all these transactions, is not valid, and it never was, according to what I understand.
Well, what happened is that the way that this has got sold to all the banks is that this became adopted by BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, in Basel, in Switzerland.
Now, let's talk about who runs that bank, just so people have a reference.
That is theoretically owned and managed by the central banks of the world, all of whom have a shareholding in it.
But doesn't Lazard Frere hold the biggest slice?
It's not supposed to be managed by private banks, no. It's not supposed to be a private institution. It's meant to be a representation of central banks of the world. And in a sense, it's where legislation for the central banks gets hammered out between them and then sent back and signed in as legislation in the different parts of the world. And in fact, right now, the new capital accord, two accounting elements of legislation, this Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 capital, came into effect as of last week in the banks. And this is a second reason for the capital window. Up until this enforced regime on all the places in the world using the same methodology, excepting whether that's right or wrong, we'll come back to that, Darrell, but all the different central banks in the world and the different regulators had different methodologies. And the idea is that they've come up with a new methodology to be adopted by the world, which will bring all the solutions. Prior to that, the US did it their way, Britain did it their way, France did it their way, Germany did it their way, and so on. This is supposed to be a level regulatory playing field and a level capital playing field. But, as you pointed out, Darrell, the methodologies don't work, and I'd like to explain why the math doesn't work. Coming to these derivative contracts, coming back to them, if we did our first asset swap, you and I, we did this asset swap, Darrell, and as you've pointed out again, these are not traded on a marketplace. These are over the counter. They're directly only between you and us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a master agreement that I signed as a bank and you signed as a bank that would govern all of these contracts. It's usually the ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivative Association's master agreement. We would have a master agreement in place that says that you and I can do as many different types of swap transactions as we want, and we put in the documentation that it's governed by our master agreement. That means that in legal terms, there is a word which comes in financial circles, Darrell, which is fungible. And that says that I can offset negatively correlated assets to minimize my capital exposure.
So that's that? Zero-sum assets.
It's kind of zero-sum. It's the old umbrellas and ice creams.
Yeah.
If we did an ice cream swap and an umbrella swap, the theory is that if it's the sun is shining, we're selling ice cream, and if it's raining, we're selling umbrellas. So we would say that those two things are negatively correlated. That's the best way to give the example on this one, Darrell.
Mm-hmm.
If we did an ice cream swap, and my value at risk on that came out at, say, $15.
Mm-hmm.
I could then do an umbrella swap with you, and the value at risk on that could be $14. And rather than add those two value at risks together and coming up with $29 for how much capital I as a bank need to hold to stay solvent, I've argued the case as a financial professional that these assets are negatively correlated. So actually, this one offsets this in the zero-sum game, leaving me only $1. So I've now got two transactions out there, and I'm only holding $1 against what is in reality $29 worth of exposure to the marketplace, Darrell.
Right.
Now imagine that I've got 14,000 transactions, and every time I do one, I offset it with another and offset with another, just hoping to squeeze this small interest rate out. And peppered in the middle of this, coming back to what you said, are all these reference assets of CDOs and other types of mortgage-backed securities, which have now blown up. So I'm now looking at 14,000 contracts in a massive pile of cards, and in the middle of that, legs have blown up left, right, and center.
In other words, that negative correlation didn't hold because the asset classes that you were offsetting all of a sudden, the ice cream and a sunny day started showing up on the same contract. Instead of a negative correlated contract, you were having two positives in one contract based upon the blowing up of certain asset packages that were being used in the correlation process.
Well, let's just imagine that out of that 14,000 swaps which I've got sat there, 200 of them were ice cream, i.e. CDOs. Only 200.
Yep.
But because those are used to counterbalance the risk in maybe another 300 or 400 swaps, I've now gone from holding the $1. All of those have blown up. I now need a huge amount of margin on those, no longer at $14 VAR, but maybe $50 VAR. So I've got to, the amount of money that I've got to hold on those 200 ice creams has gone through the roof, and they've been downgraded, which means that I can't use them to offset those umbrellas because the risks involved, we're now saying I need four ice creams to offset one umbrella because of global warming or, you know, whatever the basis is. In this instance, it's because of the type of asset, the CDOs, these subprimes have all blown up, and they're not recovering. This is like the sun's come out and it's not going to rain again.
Yeah, and your whole basics. This is a funny for people who have lived in New York. It's funny that you'd be walking down any major street in Manhattan and the rain would start, and from nowhere you'd see 100 umbrella salesmen that would come out of the woodwork. And then as soon as the rain stopped, you couldn't find one if you needed one for love nor money. In other words, all of a sudden there's no more rain and none of these umbrella salesmen are coming out, and you're stuck with four ice creams. And basically there's no more negative correlation, and so the asset has to be balanced with cash.
That's right, and that's why the central banks are rushing out. Now, Citibank is bad news, but that's very bad for the U.S. market. But what's even worse, Darrell, is Barclays. The Bank of England came out recently in the financial press and got very angry about a leak of information which stated that Barclays had to borrow £7 billion in cash from the Bank of England as a cash balance to these assets that have gone wrong. And the Bank of England came out and tried to calm everybody down, said this is a normal emergency window and Barclays and all the other banks can borrow from it, no problem.
Yeah.
Actually, what's scary, Darrell, here's what's really scary, and I'm going to come back to your $41 billion now, the window in the States. What's really scary is that Barclays have hit their limit of borrowing from the Bank of England. They're no longer good for any more cash at the Bank of England. So Barclays Capital, the element of Barclays which has taken this exposure that's holding all these ice creams that are melting in their hands, and mm-hmm. ice creams that are melting because the sun's out and it's all just, it's too hot. They've got too many of them. Nobody wants to buy them. They've actually now, according to Bloomberg, a very small article in Bloomberg that only somebody who understands bank capital management would be able to translate. But what it said in the article was that Barclays Capital, New York, has actually approached the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States and agreed a large loan in the billions of dollars, which is to be converted into sterling and sent back to the United Kingdom to keep Barclays Bank alive. Technically now, Barclays Bank is actually insolvent. It's borrowed beyond its limit at the Bank of England, and it's now borrowing from a second central bank to stay alive. And given that, you know, you understand this now, Barclays is one of the big four banks here in the UK.
That's right.
They've gone bust. And the regulators and the central bank here are so frightened of people finding out that they've given Barclays permission to secretly take these loans from the Fed.
Now, at the same time, what people don't know, and you talked about Citibank in America going to that cash window and also are reporting huge losses and their credit rating going below the AAA rating, and they're actually probably in B-plus or even lower, who knows. The fact is Morgan Stanley is the biggest holder and biggest purveyor of these packaged derivatives out into the marketplace, and so they must be belly up as well. So in other words, my point being with Morgan and Goldman and the rest of these big investment houses, they're all waiting for their turn to step up to the bad news window.
Well, Morgan actually are the ones who are probably going to take the least pain, Darrell. Although they are the culprits in convincing everybody else to buy in, they were actually part of the lead management on the bond issues, and they were actually quite often a guarantor for the issuing institution. But actually, they mainly sold them on at issue and took commission. And they
they're not holders.
They're not holders, which is very clever.
And Goldman isn't holders either. Goldman Sachs. Now, wait a minute. Goldman Sachs is the bad guys' bank. I mean, they're not a bank. They're the paper flyers from around the world, and they are part of the bad guy network. I mean, take a look at Paulson. Take a look at all of the people running this criminal network, and they all have direct ties to Goldman.
Goldman Sachs is the biggest insider trading institution in the world. It's the biggest market manipulating institution in the world. They have the markets and the ear, and they look to spread false news, take false positions. They went and shorted really, really heavily at the beginning of last week, Darrell. They took a huge amount of shorts, telling everybody still to buy, and then they announced that they'd shorted the market and the market fell, and then they changed the rating on bank to a cell, knowing the effect. I mean, to actually turn round and they did it with Merrill's as well, but it was Goldman with the prime movers on it. They actually changed it to a sell, knowing that telling everybody to sell Citibank was going to collapse the whole market. So they took a massive short position, went from a green light to a red light on Citibank, and they've just mopped up on these shorts, totally mopped up on them, made fortunes.
But you have to know, though, that they go right back to the controllers, to the Rothschild, Warburg, Schiff, Loeb, Kahn, Goldman. the whole shooting match of criminality is tied up with these people.
It is a Rothschild bank. Now, the interesting thing, Daniel, is that this new regulatory regime was not meant to blow up in the way that it has done.
Yep.
It's caught the other side hopping. Surely they're planning to implode the world financial markets once they've got into a geopolitical situation that it suits them. The fact that it's blown up now because of a poorly thought through capital management system based on greed, based on the ability to take further exposures and make more and more money from the same amount of bank capital, it's actually come back. These chickens have come home to roost, and everything's melting down early. And they're probably taking the decision, which is they're deciding, shall we run with this or shall we try and sort it out? And this brings us back to your pet topic, Daryl, the dollar. And the fact that you had the economic advisor to Ronald Reagan on stating that the central banks of the world are offloading their dollars for euros, sterling, even yen, anything really except dollars, because they as banks have a duty, central banks that is, have a duty to maintain the capital reserves for the whole country. And they obviously are seeing substantial part of their portfolio, some of them are holding 80-90% dollars as their reserves. Their capital reserves are shrinking for the whole nation, so they're selling these dollars. And these dollars, when you and I talk of the famous resistance level of 80, this basket of 80, this resistance level is also what we would call the support level. When it came to 80, the central banks of the world, for market confidence, would use the dollars that they're holding. They would actually go out and buy dollars. They would go out and buy dollars to say, no, we want to protect our dollar holding and the value of it. Now they're actually selling off those dollars, and they're saying, we're not going to support any resistance level now. We don't care where the dollar goes because we're not going to be holding them.
Yeah, well, I mean, the new support line, of course, is temporarily at 75, which is a huge drop from its previous at 80, only because the plunge protection team managed through the cash window, the Fed, the Treasury, and Goldman's, in fact, and also Morgan Stanley. They're out there in the marketplace manipulating the tar out of major companies trying to keep the stock market afloat for a short period longer while they get their ducks in a row. But this is in fact just short term, because you just saw a reversal in dollar value. But then today, of course, it reached 76 again, and then just plunged right back to near 75. You're also seeing people running into the gold investment and silver investments and platinum and other hard assets in a rush. So my point being is that they're trying to manage this descent in real time. And they're having minor successes here, but the story's already been written. The final the epilogue of this nightmare has already been penned. And basically it is that the dollar's dead, is toast, the American economy is finished, and that the world is going to slip into a depression. And I'm going to tell everybody just a little bit why it's going into depression. You have to understand the relationship between the Western culture, the Western countries, and America. America has been mopping up the goods and services of foreign countries with these overinflated valued dollars for a very long time. And so France gets about 22% of its GDP to in North America, and Germany 27, I think, percent. There are countries that get as much as 29 or 30%. That's like Korea, South Korea. My point is that they no longer will have a client to sell to very soon. That means 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 or even 2 in 5 workers are going to lose their job related to these exports. Now, think about this for a minute. A place like Spain or like England losing 2 out of 5 jobs right now. And then the knock-on effect on the high street –